Welcome to Lyo Hub, our second annual Lyo Summer School. And today we are very fortunate to have Dr. Steve Nail to present this short course, but fairly comprehensive course freeze drying. I'll give a brief intro for Steve, but in most freeze drying related audiences, Dr. Nail doesn't require an introduction. We're very fortunate to count Steve as one of our Purdue alums. Steve got an undergraduate degree in chemical engineering at Purdue, and then a PhD in industrial and physical pharmacy, also at Purdue. And then for 16 years after that, he was a scientist at Upjohn in Kalamazoo, Michigan, working on all kinds of aspects of development of parenteral products. And after that, Purdue was able to get him back on campus as an associate professor and then a full professor in industrial and physical pharmacy, where during that time, Steve made some of the seminal contributions in freeze drying and developing freeze drying as a science, including a very well-known paper on pressure, the role of chamber pressure in freeze drying, and many other. And then Steve decided to continue his industrial career, went to Lilly, was a research fellow at Lilly, and is currently a senior research fellow at Baxter in their Center of Excellence in Lyophilization and Bloomington, Indiana. Steve is also one of the leaders in the broad field of lyophilization freeze drying. He was very central to establishing LyoHub, leading that effort at Purdue. I think LyoHub is at Purdue just because of Steve.
Now that might be a little bit of a stretch.
He's also on many of the organizations in parenteral science, including UP, that you're on the committee of experts.
Oh, USP?
USP.
Yeah. I used to be, yeah.
And he's also a fellow of AAPS. So please welcome Steve.
Thank you, Alina. I can't believe you remembered all that. Nice job. Good morning, everybody. I would like to, if you don't mind, start with introductions. And I'll tell you now, I have one request. Please don't be timid about asking questions. I don't know most of you, and I don't know what your pharmaceutical background is. So by all means, if you don't understand what I'm talking about, say so, because there's probably other people in the group who don't understand what I'm talking about either. So, a course objective, expand your knowledge base and improve your critical thinking skills in the science and technology and freeze drying. We do place kind of special emphasis on understanding the concepts behind, a graphical design space approach to freeze dry process development. It's traditionally been kind of a trial and error process of coming up with a suitable, what we call a freeze dry cycle. And the problem with that is freeze drying is at best very inefficient. But the least we can do is come up with cycle conditions that make the process as efficient as we can make it. I mean, I said kind of lightly that we need to take a blank piece of paper and redesign a freeze dryer. We could make it a lot more efficient by using a different heat source, for example. But there are the understanding of the design space requires that you understand the fundamentals of heat transfer, mass transfer, equipment capability, recognizing that any freeze dryer has a limit on the sublimation rate that it will support. And that limit is generally a function of chamber pressure. It's important to understand, you know, what that limit is and how you go about measuring it. In addition to that, there's a materials characterization piece, understanding that any formulation that we want to freeze dry has a limit as to how warm it can get during what we call primary drying, or you're going to ruin it. So these all kind of come together in this graphical design space, which allows you to determine the most efficient set of processing conditions for that formulation and for a given piece of equipment. So to walk through the outline here, we'll talk, initially, the reason we're doing this introduction and process overview is I realize a lot of you don't have pharmaceutical backgrounds, so I want to talk a little more broadly about some of the unit operations we use. I work now for Baxter Healthcare in a division called Global Science and Technology. I'm actually based in Bloomington, Indiana. And the main business in Bloomington is contract manufacturer of injectable pharmaceutical products. We don't make anything other than injectables. And what's unusual about the facility in Bloomington is that contract manufacturers usually don't have R&D groups, but Baxter Bloomington does, and I'm a part of that group of about 15 people who do analytical method development and what we call formulation and process development. So, we'll talk about advantages and limitations of freeze drying. We'll talk about product quality attributes and why we care. Give a broad overview of the three main parts of freeze drying, that being freezing, where we're trying to solidify the material as best we can. Primary drying, where we're removing ice from the product by direct sublimation. Then secondary drying. Secondary drying is necessary that in most real formulations, not all of the water freezes, and you've got to get rid of that water too, or at least you've got to get rid of most of that. That is removed then during secondary drying. Okay? We'll focus then, we'll zero in a bit more on the freezing process, which consists of supercooling, ice nucleation. We'll talk about characterization of freezing behavior. Low-temperature thermal analysis. Ruben Yablus from Macron is going to be here. He does a really nice job of talking about freeze-dry microscopy, how you do it, and why we care. So he'll have a lecture, and then there's a demonstration of that. So it's really nice of him to come down. Establishing the upper product temperature limit during primary drying. We'll talk about heat transfer, particularly measurement of something called the vial heat transfer coefficient. That's something we need to know to construct this graphical design space. We'll talk about mass transfer considerations and measuring the resistance of the dry product layer. When we're typically talking about freeze drying of a material that's in a glass vial, and we freeze that material, and during primary drying, there's a visible sublimation front that moves from the top to the bottom of that frozen material, meaning that as drying proceeds, the water vapor from the sublimation process has to make its way through a partly dried porous bed of material, and the resistance of that porous bed is going to increase with time and with depth of the dried layer. We want to be able to measure the resistance to mass transfer associated with that layer, and that's easy enough to do, but we'll walk through it. And then secondary drying, about critical process variables during secondary drying. We'll talk a little bit about determining how dry is dry enough. Then there's equipment capability piece, things that limit equipment performance. We'll talk a little bit about sonic velocity and choked flow. It's how actually we got in collaboration with our aeronautical engineering colleagues during the time I was with Eli Lilly. We encountered a scale-up problem where cycle conditions were developed in the laboratory. It was scaled up at a contract manufacturer in Kansas, and it went very badly. They found that they couldn't control the pressure during the freeze-dry cycle. And we developed a hypothesis that it was choked flow, but that was a new subject to me at the time. And there was a group of guys when I was at Purdue I ran with at noontime. I referred to those guys as the varsity, but one of my running buddies was John Sullivan, who was then the head of the aeronautical engineering department. We had him come down to Lilly for a day, and basically he confirmed, yes, you have a choked flow issue, which turns out it can be a significant issue in scale-up. And from John, I got introduced to Alina, and we've been interacting ever since. That's been several years ago now. So we'll talk about that, how you measure equipment capability, something called a choke point test, and something called minimum controllable pressure. We'll have a piece on process monitoring and control. We'll talk about formulation. By that, I mean any pharmaceutical product has a a recipe for what's in there and a process that you use to make it. The formulation, it's all of the components, though particularly those that are not the active pharmaceutical ingredient, which we call the API. There might be buffers and bulking agents and tonicity and adjusting agents and so forth. And the freeze-drying characteristics are very much affected by the components that are part of that formulation. And then we'll have a piece where we put this all together and we'll construct the graphical design space. And we'll have at the end, I'll hand out some case studies. I'm assuming that most of you have laptops available. I think Jen sent you an Excel spreadsheet. So I'm basically now, I want to give you a case study and then you have you identify optimized process conditions based on the information in that case study. The sort of, I hope we'll tie all this together. This is what a design space looks like. I don't expect it to make much sense now. There are a couple sets of isotherms. The black ones are shelf temperature isotherms. The red ones are product temperature isotherms. That blue line is the equipment capability. The green shaded area then is all of the combinations of shelf temperature and chamber pressure, the two critical process variables during primary drying, that result in a pharmaceutically acceptable product that is within the capability of the equipment. And I hope by the end of this course, this all makes sense. Before I do that, you know, given that some of you are non-pharmaceutical, I'll just kind of give you an overview of unit operations that are involved in manufacturing a freeze-dried drug product. And these are basis. This is kind of a slide tour. One of the disadvantages of Baxter Bloomington is there are not a lot of windows. It's hard to take people around and show them. So sometimes you just have to settle for photographs. But in sort of a block diagram form, we have dispensing of all of the components that will be part of that formulation. I mentioned buffers and bulking agents and API and tonicity adjusting agents. And there might be other things there as well. Something to enhance solubility, for example. You dissolve the formulation components. Usually there are some in-process controls. It might be a pH adjustment. It might be a clarity determination, some maybe just optical determination of clarity, making sure that all the components have completely dissolved. Sometimes there's an in-process potency check where you have variability batch to batch in potency of this material, and you need to adjust the volume to get the potency per milliliter, for example, within a certain target range. There's, of course, an equipment preparation piece, washing, sterilization. After we get the formulation, get the composition right, there's a sterile filtration step. And it would be sterile filtered into a vessel that might look like this, a stainless steel vessel. These are typically sterilized in place with using steam under pressure. Notice the garb of this individual. He's completely covered. You know all about this too, most of you who've worked in a clean room environment. The dirtiest thing that ever goes into a clean room is a person. We're always sloughing off our skin. When I was teaching sterile products, I brought a particle counter into the room just to demonstrate how filthy uncontrolled air is. It's got, you know, it might have 200, 300, 400,000 particles per cubic foot of air. And then I'd ask everybody to stand up and sit down, and you see the particle counts go up. So there's this whole invisible world of airborne particulate matter that we have to deal with in clean room technology, and that's one way to do it. This is a sterile filtration operation. Those two cartridges there are those two pieces of stainless steel have cartridges of pleated filter material. We filter through a 0.22 micron filter, and it's redundant. It goes through those filters in series. It's just added sterility assurance. In case there's a breach in the integrity of one filter, the second filter really should take care of it. It's common practice in the industry. So then we've got the preparation to do. We're going to wash vials. Okay, so we wash vials. We typically use just sterile water for injection. We use a lot of water, and high purity pharmaceutical water is a subject into itself. There's a lot of detail involved. Following washing, there's depyrogenation. If you're not familiar with depyrogenation, I don't have a lot of time to go into that, but basically it's deactivating components of the outer cell wall of most or many, if not most, gram-negative bacteria. So we heat it up to high temperature for a fairly long dwell time. We also wash and siliconize the stoppers, the elastomeric materials that go on the top of this glass vial. Sterilization there is by steam, typically. And these all come together in the filling machine. Okay. And this is sort of a block diagram of the process itself. This is the vial washing machine. From the vial washing machines, it goes to the depyrogenation tunnel. From the, this is in a clean environment, but not what we call grade A, not the cleanest. Then it goes into a filling room that is the cleanest environment in terms of airborne particulate matter, airborne, microbiological matter. FM is for the filling machine. From the filling machine, it goes to what's called a loader, unloader, accumulator table. We do automatic loading and unloading of freeze dryers. One of the things that is, sterile products technology advances, one of the things you want to do is keep people away from the product. One of the ways to do that is to use automatic loading, unloading systems. It used to be an entirely manual operation where operators would carry trays of filled vials from the filling line to the freeze dryer. You want to get away from that. Potential contamination, plus this goes back to my Upjohn days, some of those trays of product can be very heavy, and many operators over a number of years will develop back problems just from lugging those trays around. So, loader, unloader, accumulator table, there's something called a transfer car that moves those, that array of vials, to the freeze dryer. Okay. This is a, vial washing machine. We start out with shrink wrap packs of vials. The operator typically takes a knife and cuts the plastic and turns this shrink wrap pack of vials over. That they then enter the filling machine. They go through, or the washing machine. They go through a series of washing steps with water for injection. After that, they go into the depyrogenation tunnel, which is shown back here, this Bosch and Strobel machine. Time and temperature is variable, but typically 325 degrees for maybe a dwell time of 45 minutes or so is enough to inactivate pyrogens or bacterial endotoxins. There's a preheating zone, a drying and sterilizing zone, and there's also a cooling zone. And after the cooling zone, the depyrogenated vials are transferred to an accumulator table. Shown here, this shows the vials. This is the depyrogenation tunnel. This is the vials coming out of the tunnel. They go onto this accumulator table where the vials then line up and ultimately make their way to a filling machine. Back a step. This is a stopper processing piece of equipment. And there are several kinds of unit operations that are used for washing and sterilizing stoppers. It could be a fluidized bed kind of an arrangement. It's not here. This is just a batch-wise mechanism for washing and sterilizing stoppers. The plastic jugs are for detergents that might be used in cleaning the stoppers. Yes?
I just had a quick question. You mentioned 325 degrees.
Yeah.
Is that Celsius or Fahrenheit?
Oh, that's Celsius. I'm sorry. Okay. 325 degrees Celsius. Well above the temperature that we would do steam sterilization. It simply takes that high a temperature for that long a time to inactivate pyrogens. Some people say kill pyrogens, but that's not a right term. They were never alive to begin with. You inactivate them just with a high temperature a long time. May or may not use a detergent. For us, it's sort of a client-specific thing. They often have specific instructions about how they want us to do manufacturing, and we comply with that as best we can. This is just a shot of vials making their way to the filling machine. Every vial gets weighed before and after it's filled. It's pretty impressive technology because this equipment can fill something like 600 vials a minute, yet every vial gets weighed before and after it's filled, and records are kept of that fill volume. So this filling process is very precisely controlled. Okay, this is a filling machine. There are several kinds of filling machines. This is a peristaltic device. We also have what's called time pressure filling, and we also have syringe pump kind of filling. And we're finding more and more in the area of protein therapeutic products. There's good reason to care about that. If you read the literature on shear denaturation of proteins, it leads you to the conclusion that in pharmaceutical unit operations, it doesn't seem that enough shear would be applied to a protein for a long enough time to cause it to partly unfold. But we're finding that that whole thing needs to be questioned, because we've seen cases where with client products of protein pharmaceuticals, it makes a difference. In other words, we've had batches where we've used a syringe pump type filter that after this is, and this is for liquid products, not referring to freeze-dried products right now, but after a period of time, they start to develop visible particulate matter. Well, that's a problem, because if an injectable contains visible particulate matter, you can't use it. You have to throw that away. Where we find that for the same formulation, if we use this peristaltic pump, doesn't seem to be subject to that. So we have this working hypothesis. There's a difference between filling machines and the amount of shear denaturation of proteins, but it's an area that just needs to be explored more. Just another shot of the filling process. Here you can see the top, the neck area of the vial and the tubing that carrying the formulation to the individual filling needles. As the vials are moving, the assembly of filling needles is moving like this and filling these vials. As I said, we can do up to 600 a minute. This, if you're not familiar with it, this is what a vial of product. Now this is showing freeze-dried solid, but what I'm trying to show you here is for a filled vial, this elastomeric closure that contains slots, the stopper is partially seated. It actually goes down to it. It hits a little projection on the outside of that stopper so that these slots are open during the freeze-dry process. Of course, you've got to give the water vapor a way to get out. During the drying process itself, the stoppers are on this partially raised position, and then when drying process is over, the shelves of the freeze dryer are hydraulically compressed together, pushes the closure down into its fully seated position. And you can carry out that process under basically any pressure you want. But most products are stoppered under a partial vacuum, you know, maybe half an atmosphere or so. Yes.
If you're not using vials, say you're using like trays,
yeah,
or some other more open container,
right?
Is it good enough just to use like tin foil to stop that, or are there special materials you use to?
There are, what you're talking about is what we call bulk freeze drying, where you would have a pan or a tray of a formulation that you want to freeze dry. And you have to worry about how am I going to contain the powder during the freeze-dry process. When I was in grad school, the limited freeze-drying I did was freeze-drying in a beaker that we just took a Kim wipe and a rubber band and put that over the beaker. But they make special equipment. It's called a...
Lyoguard,
yeah. It uses Gore-Tex. The Gore-Tex is such that the water vapor will go through the Gore-Tex, but it still provides protection for the product. They're kind of expensive, but they're also very useful. Okay, so there's a stoppering station here. There's a mechanism for recognizing vials that didn't get a stopper. This is probably simulated, but all these vials have stoppers. They're going one way, and for some reason, stoppers got missed, and they're routed off into another direction. This is just another view down the filling line with the filling machine being here. And these vials are on the way to the loader, unloader, accumulator table where this table that's shown here, it gets loaded or it's filled one row at a time. Then there's a put as these vials make their way across the table, then there's a push plate that pushes them forward until you get the whole loader, unloader, accumulator table filled. And the area of this is the same as the area of a shelf of the freeze dryer. This is what we call a T-car or a transfer cart. It maintains a grade A, or if you like, class 100 better. It maintains clean conditions within this tray, where here's the loader, unloader, accumulator table. The transfer cart moves along these rails, and then in this position, it reaches across here, grabs that array of vials, drags it onto this part of the transfer cart, then it does a 180-degree pivot, goes to the appropriate freeze dryer, lines it up with the shelves, and then pushes an entire shelf worth of vials onto that shelf of the freeze dryer. This is what the door looks like of a production-sized freeze dryer. BOC Edwards is now EMA Life. We use EMA Life freeze dryers in manufacturing, but I think they've all got BOC Edwards on them. This have what's called a partial door. Well, sometimes people call this a pizza door that's used for loading and unloading. With that door open, basically one shelf at a time is brought to the level of the transfer cart, and basically it's loaded one shelf at a time. Then the stack of shelves, there are 11 shelves in this freeze dryer, it moves up one, the transfer cart makes another trip to the loader, unloader, accumulator table, and it makes 11 of those circuits, then the freeze dryer is loaded and the process goes on. This is just a shot of the inside. Notice the shiny surface. I think these are really beautiful. There's an awful lot of hours of mechanical polishing here, but it's important simply for cleanability of the freeze dryer. The downside of that, if you're familiar with thermal radiation, and thermal radiation does make a difference in pharmaceutical freeze drying, the amount of heat transferred by thermal radiation is influenced by the emissivity of the surface involved in the heat transfer process. And the shinier that surface, the lower the emissivity and the less efficient the heat transfer by thermal radiation. Of course, as freeze dryers get older and they've been steam sterilized many, many times, that eventually these materials darken. And a sort of an open question is, how much do I have to worry about that, the increasing emissivity of the surface with age as far as the influence that that could have on the cycle and perhaps the product itself? And then after the process, it gets repeated. The one shelf at a time is brought out of the freeze dryer, and then it goes on to capping equipment right here. We have a sister facility in Halle, Germany that specializes in cytotoxic agents. We don't manufacture cytotoxic agents in Bloomington, and therefore we don't have an external vial wash. Our colleagues in Halle that do manufacture cytotoxics have an external vial wash. The reason for that is a lot of times in freeze drying, because of the velocity of water vapor coming out of the product, will carry some powder, some solids out the slots in the vial, and leave a sort of a fine dust over the outside surface of all the vials in that load. And for safety reasons, you want to clean that external surface. It's called powder ejection. It's both formulation dependent and process dependent. Then after that, we have inspection and labeling. The inspection process in Bloomington is largely a manual process. There is developing technology for, yes?
Just a quick question. When some of that powder does come out, right, now the weight of that material that's inside that vial is not the same anymore. Do you guys check for that, or is there like an issue, like for example, if a vial is missing some powder, is the concentration of that not a good medicine anymore?
Yeah, that's a good point. In principle, you're right that if you're ejecting powder from the vial, you're losing mass, but it isn't monitored, but it's been examined before. And it turns out that in most cases, the mass of powder is so small that you're not even going to be able to measure it. And the reason for the vial wash is just a conservative step to make sure there's nothing there on the outside. Now, during development, that may not be the case. I mean, there was a project I worked on many years ago that was a T-butanol water co-solvent system that results in a very fluffy freeze-dried powder. And there was one case where we started a cycle in the afternoon, came back the next morning, looked in the freeze dryer, and there's no powder in the vials. It's all over the freeze dryer. So that was just we didn't realize how friable and how fluffy this material was and how easily it's just blown out of the vial by velocity of water vapor. But, you know, by the time it gets to commercial manufacture, you've solved those kind of problems, and it's just you add an extra step to be cautious. You're not losing enough mass to matter. Okay, sure. So what is freeze drying? Most of you already know that, but if we start at the beginning, we have to at least consider the phase diagram of water with pressure on the y-axis, temperature on the x-axis. These lines are simply showing you what phases exist at equilibrium as a function of temperature and pressure. In most drying operations, we're in this part of the phase diagram where we have phase transfer from liquid to vapor. It turns out that traditional drying processes involve too much thermal degradation on heat-sensitive products for conventional drying to be practical. Of course, this part is going from the solid to the liquid, and down below what we call the triple point of water, that's at just a little bit above 0 degrees and about 4.5 millimeters of mercury. Below the triple point, we have phase transition from solid to vapor that takes place without going through an intermediate liquid phase. That's what makes freeze drying, and it's this part of the phase diagram that we're interested in from here on. Okay, so why do we freeze dry? Well, as I already mentioned, it allows removal of water vapor at a low temperature, so you avoid the damage that's caused by conventional drying methods, tray drying, spray drying, or any other of those more traditional operations. It's compatible with aseptic operations. What I mean by that is that it's practical to apply sanitary design criteria to a freeze dryer. It's easy enough to separate the dirty parts of the equipment from the clean parts of the equipment, and it can be designed such that it's readily cleanable in place and sterilizable in place. Operationally, it's easier than, for example, filling a dry powder in a vial. Filling a dry powder in a vial, it's done, certainly, because many times it has to be. Our sister facility in Halle, Germany, does a lot of powder filling, not because they want to, but because they have to. And some of the operational problems might include fill weight uniformity, getting the same mass of powder in every vial, because you have to deal with within batch and between batch variability in mechanical properties of that powder, bulk density, compressibility, flow ability. All of those can influence your ability to get the same amount of material in every vial, where you don't have to worry about that if you're filling a liquid. It's much easier to fill it precisely as a solution as opposed to a bulk powder. You also don't have the dust to deal with. We've already talked about that a little bit. When I was on the faculty here in pharmacy, the Eli Lilly invited the senior class down for a two-day tour every year. Students really liked it, and it was a very, very nice thing for them to get an inside look at a pharmaceutical company. And I often went along as an accompanying faculty member, and we walked by the dry powder filling at Lilly, and I remember thinking to myself, this isn't something that I would put on a tour. You look in that room and everything is covered with dust. So you have to worry about what we call cross contamination, which is getting one kind of drug mixed in with another. You never want that. And the potential for operator exposure, even for things that are not cytotoxic. Many times you just don't want people breathing dust of any kind. So, and from a pharmaceutical development perspective, the kind of work that people like me do, a freeze-dried drug product has a higher probability of technical success than a sterile ready-to-use solution. Part of that is because of the tendency of these ready-to-use solutions to develop particulate matter over time. When you do see visible particulate matter developing, you've got a bit of a research project on your hands in the sense that you have to figure out, well, what is that particle? Where did it come from? And what do I have to do to get rid of it? It can be very small particles, colloidal material, that over a period of time, weeks or months, aggregates into visible particulate matter. And then you say, well, then what are we going to do about this initial subvisible, this colloidal material that tends to aggregate? So that can really draw out the whole development process. With a freeze-dried drug product, you don't have to worry about that generally. Downside of freeze-drying. Well, it's not as convenient to administer a freeze-dried injectable product as it is to administer a sterile, ready-to-use solution. If you think about it for a minute, if you have a freeze-dried product, first thing you have to do is what we call reconstitute. You have to add water and dissolve the solid material. So you take a syringe of probably bacteriostatic water for injection, and you stick the needle through the headspace of the vial. You inject the liquid in. You swirl the vial to get all of the solids into solution. Well, that transfer step is an opportunity for, if you have a breach of asepsis, to introduce microorganisms into that vial. Then you've got another step. Once the solid is dissolved, you take a needle and syringe and you withdraw the contents of the vial. So there's another transfer step there. From there, now you've got the reconstituted material in a syringe, and let's say you're going to put it in a plastic bag of normal saline or 5% dextrose, something you're going to use for infusion. So you've got another transfer step of reconstituted drug product to bag of diluent, let's say. Every one of those is an opportunity for contamination of the product if there's a breach of asepsis. So that would be a downside of freeze drying. There's a tremendous amount of activity in what we call pre-filled syringes. Now, that really applies mostly to solution products where the only transfer step you've got is injecting that either into a person directly, into the muscle or a vein, or into a bag of diluent if it's for what we call IV infusion. So you've minimized the amount of transfer steps by using a pre-filled syringe. Another downside, it takes a long time. It's very inefficient. Equipment's expensive. And this inevitably adds to the cost of the product. And finally, the drug may not be stable as a freeze-dried solid. We'll come back to that because this sort of introduces the issue of the influence of the physical state of a solid on its solid state stability, amorphous versus crystalline. There are plenty of examples of a product that's in its amorphous form is not stable in the solid state, whereas the corresponding crystal form is stable. And part of the reason our colleagues in Halle, Germany do dry powder filling is they're dealing with materials that don't like to crystallize from a freezing aqueous solution. If you're doing dry powder filling, you're not really stuck with using water as a solvent. They can use a lot of different solvents and come up with a solvent or solvent combinations that gets that drug to crystallize. Then you can dry that material and then you fill that crystallized dry powder into a vial. You've still got the operational issues to deal with, but at least you've got a viable product that's going to be stable for a reasonable shelf life of 2 years or so. Okay, we need to talk a little bit about quality attributes of a freeze-dried product and why we care. Reconstitution or rehydration. You want it to be complete or at least consistent in reconstitution time and fully get recovery of the biological activity after reconstitution. Not every product is going to give you complete recovery of activity after freeze drying. Vaccines are a good example. It's not unusual to lose a couple logarithms of infectivity titer, for example, after freeze drying a vaccine. But in that case, you really don't care because you don't have the traditional dose dependent response. You need to inject enough vaccine to elicit the immune response. And beyond that, the amount that you inject is sort of a secondary consideration. But again, if you can't get complete recovery, at least you need it to be consistent from batch to batch and from vial to vial. Sterile and with adequately low level of bacterial endotoxin. If you're not familiar with the USP, United States Pharmacopeia, it's a Bible of quality standards for pharmaceutical products, and it contains standards for the level of bacterial endotoxin, for example. Rapid complete reconstitution. We'd really like that because you don't want a doctor or a nurse or a pharmacist shaking a vial for 15 or 20 minutes trying to get all the solids into solution. It's a problem, though, with some protein therapeutic agents where we're dealing with high concentrations, maybe 100 milligrams per mil of a monoclonal antibody, for example. And many times these high concentration protein formulations take a long time to reconstitute. It's a technical question that we just have to deal with and try to minimize those problems. But in most cases, if you do the formulation and the process appropriately, they should rapidly and completely reconstitute. And when I say rapid, I mean within a couple of minutes. It seems to me that if it takes longer than about 5 minutes, you're going to get some complaints from doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and so forth. Suitably stable at the anticipated storage conditions. Adequately low level of residual moisture. We'll have a little bit more to say about that a bit later on. And then finally, the appearance of the freeze-dried solid, including the question, you know, how much do we really care about what the freeze-dried solid looks like? And you get different kinds of different opinions. This was kind of introduces you to the concept of collapse of a freeze-dried product. That is what we would call a pharmaceutically unacceptable appearance. We would like it. I mean, there's some solids on the side that probably splashed there during the filling process. But we would like for the freeze-dried solid to have the same size and shape as the liquid that we originally filled into the vial. We'd like to have it to have a uniform color and a uniform texture. This one would pretty much meet those criteria for an ideal appearance. And this is the other end of that. It looks awful. And more importantly than that, this appearance of the cake is going to be reflected in things that you can actually measure that sort of outside of the visible looking at the vial, like reconstitution time. Generally, collapsed material will reconstitute slowly, and over a practical time frame, it may not reconstitute at all. And it's going to tend to have a high residual moisture level. And that can have adverse impact on stability of the drug product. Usually, but not always, you'd like the freeze-dried solid to have the lowest level of residual moisture that you can practically attain. There is such thing as over-drying, and we need to be aware of that. But as a general rule, drier is better. And in a product that looks like this, you're going to have a really hard time getting it adequately dry, which means it may not be adequately stable. This is something that we call partial collapse. I mentioned before that when we freeze the material, we start out with a sublimation front at the top, and we're applying heat from the bottom, which in engineering terms doesn't make perfect sense, but that's how we do it. And we have a receding boundary layer here, a visible sublimation front that moves from the top of that frozen material to the bottom. So it's moving into a warmer system, into a temperature gradient. There has to be a temperature gradient there. And at this point, it moved into a gradient such that you got an increase in the amount of collapse that was taking place. Now, this isn't gross collapse, but it's cake shrinkage. It's kind of visible indication that the process isn't under adequate control. So you generally would not want to accept something that looks like that. There is such thing as cake shrinkage that is not collapse. What I want you to notice in this product is, can you see that the freeze-dried solids is pulled away from the inner wall of this vial? That is cake shrinkage, not associated with collapse. And what many people think is going on there is that after primary drying is over, you've gotten rid of the ice, but you've still got unfrozen water associated with the solid. As you pull that unfrozen water out, you're basically decreasing the specific volume of the material, and it sets up a stress within the solids. And there's two ways that the stress can be relieved: by pulling away from the sidewall of the vial, or by developing cracks in the cake. So in this case, you have a little bit of investigating to do, and you have to answer the question, is that appearance caused by collapse, or is it cake shrinkage not associated with collapse? And you do that by carrying out the process under increasingly aggressive conditions. If it gets worse, it's probably because of collapse. If it doesn't, the cake has this appearance irrespective of the process conditions you use, it's cake shrinkage not associated with collapse, and it's a cake appearance that's simply a result of the physics of the process, and you should consider that material acceptable. This is an example of cake cracking, what I talked about before, where evidently the stress involved in secondary drying, pulling out the unfrozen water, is relieved by developing these cracks in the freeze-dried solid. Again, now many people will say that's a defective product. I wouldn't agree. And in fact, we write project proposals and we'll respond to a request for a proposal and say that the freeze-dried solid should be not shrunken or cracked. Well, many times there's nothing you can do about this. And I think it has to do with how tightly the solids adhere to the inner wall of the vial. When they adhere strongly, that stress is most likely relieved by developing cracks in the material. But again, it's just the result of the physics of the process. It doesn't indicate that there's anything defective about the product, as long as it reconstitutes quickly and completely, and you retain the biological activity and adequately low residual moisture, and so forth. But people debate, I mentioned it because people debate this a lot in the industry about what is considered acceptable. Sometimes cake appearance is stuff that's just the physics of the process, and you really can't do anything about it, and you really shouldn't have to worry about it. See anything wrong with this picture? Yeah, it's got stuff on. This is the powder ejection that I referred to earlier. These are all freeze dried together. They don't all do it, but it's a case where the solids in the freeze dried cake were not cohesive enough to prevent some of the material from being blown upward by the water vapor that's coming off that sublimation front, and it carries material into the neck area of the vial. Why do we care about that? There's no penalty for wrong answers. Why would you care about having some material up here?
Sterility.
I'm sorry, sterility, yes. Yeah. There's the potential to lose material. We don't know that we haven't blown some material out the slots in the stopper, so that's a concern. But certainly what we call container closure integrity. If you have solids in the neck area of the vial, you have to assume that some solids have gotten between the sealing surfaces of the glass and the elastomeric closure, so that container closure integrity and therefore sterility of that product has been compromised.
From the start of the production process till now, how do you know that there may not have been a chemistry problem where the yield in one case may have been lower, but you're seeing less of a product, and you don't know whether that's from what you're doing or what the chemist is doing? Like, how would you troubleshoot, figure out whether the mass loss was from you or from someone earlier in the process?
Well, you're talking about a mass loss, not necessarily a potency loss.
Because we were talking about what are the potential problems, and if you see a couple vials where maybe, okay, you may have lost some mass. How do you know that's from the lyophilization process or from some earlier problem?
Yeah, I mean, you're right.
It got less yield.
It could be from the lyophilization process, or it could be from the filling process. You know, maybe a vial didn't get filled correctly. Right? You mean stuff like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess when would you as the lyophilization expert worry?
Well, I would worry if I started seeing vial to vial variability in weight of the freeze-dried solid. We don't typically see that. One of the reasons we take such pains with the filling process is that if everything's working correctly, an underfilled or an overfilled vial isn't even going to get as far as the freeze dryer. And we know that our API is okay because we check the potency on the API before we ever start the formulation process. And we know that we typically start out with a uniform solution. So the activity is distributed uniformly into this sterile filtered aqueous solution. So that would really, then any kind of vial to vial variability would point a finger at the freeze dry process.
And you spent 2 to 10 years in process development.
Yeah. Yeah, you've done a lot of homework by this point. Have you ever seen this in a vial of freeze-dried product? It's a skin, a film of material. It doesn't look very good. Nobody understands it very well either. I think it's probably an artifact of the freezing process where we have, we'll come back to this in a bit, but you have nucleation of ice and crystal growth of the ice, and typically that you'll see that crystal growth process taking place from the bottom to the top of the vial, such that it's pushing freeze concentrate from the bottom to the top, and that the most concentrated freeze concentrate tends to be on the top. And this may just be a result of the freeze concentration effect pushing the most concentrated material to the top of the frozen layer. It doesn't look very good, but our point of view is as long as it doesn't cause delayed reconstitution, in other words, if this skin of material is difficult to dissolve, that might be a cause for rejection. It also has the potential to influence the process by retarding flow of water vapor from sublimation front out to the vial. But this, a typical skin looks like this. It's very thin, very fragile. It's got a lot of holes in it so that it typically doesn't really represent a rate-limiting step as far as water vapor being able to make its way from sublimation front out to out the slots in the stopper and out of the vial. It's something that has to be dealt with pretty much on a case-by-case basis. This is a phenomenon that we call puffing. Notice how there's it looks like the ghosts of bubbles that had been there before. Something bubbles up, and then the bubbles dry, and you end up with a system that looks like this, not very appealing looking. It could be what we call eutectic melting. We'll get to that later. Could be collapse. More to say about that later. But the idea is that in the formulation process, we're dissolving these materials, adjusting pH, and doing whatever we're doing at atmospheric pressure. There's a certain amount of air that's in solution as well. And when we freeze the system, you know, we freeze concentrate material, we freeze concentrate the air that was there first, and so that you can get little bubbles coming out. And when Ruben does his demonstration a bit later today, you'll probably see that you can see in many cases a lot of little bubbles that are in this frozen material. And if we get either collapse or eutectic melting, the viscosity of that system is going to go down pretty dramatically. Those air bubbles can expand and make their way to the surface. And that's probably what we have going on here. We don't like that, not only because it doesn't look good, but also because it's a visual indication of a process that isn't under adequate control. We must have had some collapse or some eutectic melting going on. This is a phenomenon that we call fogging. It's where a film of liquid from the, this happens as soon as the vial is filled, long before it's frozen, we'll get a film of liquid crawling up the inner surface of the vial. And that's been kind of a mystery for a long time. I think you'll agree with me, this doesn't look very good. You'd like that not to take place. Also, you don't want it climbing too high on the vial because of what we said before. If you get material up around the neck area of the vial, you have to assume that you may have compromised container closure integrity. In our world, we have to deal with unhappy clients, and they're not going to like this. And their explanation for it was that, well, you guys are not being careful when you move material from the filling line to the freeze dryer. You're sloshing around the vial, and it's leaving this film of solution on the inner surface of the glass. Well, that's a sensible hypothesis, but in most cases, it isn't true, because if you can take a vial, leave it on a bench top, and take a pipette and carefully fill the solution, and you can actually see this film of liquid climbing the wall of the vial. It's not capillary action, because it doesn't have the right surface tension dependence. The prevailing opinion is that it's something called Marangoni flow, which is flow that's driven by a surface tension gradient. One of the ways to deal with that is to use a vial that has a hydrophobic inner surface, either a siliconized vial or something called a top lyo vial that has a hydrophobic inner surface. That won't take place. But again, whether it's a critical defect or not is really a judgment call. There's no right answer in the back of the book, unless, as I said, we get solids up in this neck area of the vial. In our world, when this becomes an issue, during the inspection process, they'll put the vials in a little sleeve where the vial sits down in this sleeve to a level that corresponds to the label of the vial. As long as any of this is below the label, it's considered acceptable. If it extends above the label, it gets rejected. But again, it's an area that where more research is needed. Yeah, Drew?
Hey, based on your experience, So when that happens, what's the correlation to like the overall cake appearance? Does it look okay?
Yeah, that's a good point. This some people call it fogging. That's the most common term. There doesn't seem to be any correlation or relationship between the appearance of the cake and the presence of fogging, probably because it involves a very small amount of material. It's just that it's easy to see. And typically fogging isn't this sort of gross. It's more like a wispy appearing film on the inner surface of the vial. This is meant to demonstrate, I don't know how well you can see this, an inconsistent texture of the freeze-dried solids. Notice how it's a very fine-grained material here, and here it looks like it's almost like there are coarse crystals of a product. This is an antibiotic called vancomycin. Many drug products, the formulation consists of drug only. There's no excipient, there's no filler, no buffer, nothing but the drug itself. And many people will question this inconsistent texture of the material. I don't know exactly why that happens in this case. I don't know that anybody does. But I do know that it's an artifact of the dynamics of the freezing process. And even though the texture is inconsistent, it's not reflected in any way in potency. The things we've talked about, the potency, the recon time, anything that you'd measure looks okay. So you could consider that is an acceptable looking material. And as to why it has a variability in texture would be nice to know, but I don't think anybody can give a detailed explanation of that. This is what we call a raised cake, not uncommon in freeze drying, where the solid material is levitated off the bottom of the vial. Again, it's something that we deal with that isn't very well understood. I think in this case, it's a result of collapse. I think, as I said before, that the sublimation front moves into a temperature gradient, moves toward a higher temperature. And many times when you get collapse, you get loss of contact with the frozen material. And I think that's what happened here. There was because you can see some residue on the bottom of the vial that looks like collapsed or partly collapsed material. And when collapse took place near the bottom of the vial, there was still enough water vapor coming from this region to push the cake up, and in this case, it just kind of stayed there. But we also see cake levitation, raised cakes, where we don't see any residue on the bottom of the vial. It's a concern because once this happens, you lose thermal contact of this material with the heat source. So again, it's kind of a visual indication of a process that's not under adequate control, or maybe a poor formulation, or maybe both. So, I said before, we've got three main parts. We have a freezing, where we're trying to solidify the contents of every vial. During primary drying, we're removing by sublimation ice from the frozen matrix. This occurs by bulk flow from a region of higher pressure, which is the surface of the ice in the product vial, to a region of lower pressure. Actually, it's the condenser. We have with a freeze drying equipment typically consists of a chamber with a duct connecting it to a condenser that's running at, maybe minus 70, minus 80 degrees. So we have a gradient in vapor pressure of ice between product and condenser, which is running much lower than the product temperature. That's the driving force for the process. During secondary drying, I've said before, we remove the fraction of the water that didn't freeze. Now that's largely by a process of diffusion, okay? Molecular motion from a region of higher concentration in the partially dried solid to a region of lower concentration. And there are two rate processes in freeze drying. We have a heat transfer component. The product is, or the vial is sitting on a shelf that has typically a low viscosity silicone oil being circulated and flowing in a serpentine pattern from the entrance to the exit port of that shelf. That's providing the heat for sublimation. The heat has to go through a series of resistances. There's a resistance. This is a bit of an exaggeration, but it's just meant to show that the bottom of a vial is not flat, particularly what we call a molded vial, not very flat at all. It often has stippling little ridges or bumps on the outer, near the outer circumference on the bottom of the vial that inhibits contact. So there is a contact resistance that's often is the controlling resistance in this step. There's resistance associated with the frozen layer as well. So again, we have a heat transfer largely by conduction. People debate whether convection is a significant heat transfer mechanism. I don't think the question's been completely resolved. And thermal radiation plays a component as well. So we've got two, probably three mechanisms of getting the heat of sublimation from the heat source to the heat sink where it's required. Okay, so that's the heat transfer piece. We'll revisit that a little bit later. So there's the mass transfer piece is you've got water vapor. You've got a change in state from solid to vapor that has to make its way through a porous bed of partly dried solids as the sublimation front moves downward. That depth increases, and so as you go through the process, it's going to have a bit more difficulty making its way through those solids. I haven't shown a partially inserted stopper on that vial, but there's typically one there. So there's a mass transfer resistance associated with the product. There is a mass transfer resistance associated with the partly inserted stopper, and there may be a resistance associated with the chamber condenser configuration itself. The limiting resistance in mass transfer is almost always this partly dried layer of product where you have pores in there that are roughly on the order of 50 micrometers or so. It can vary considerably. And people often ask, we have a partially inserted stopper, and it's not uncommon for people to ask, you know, how far out of whack does the stopper need to be before it becomes a limiting resistance to mass transfer? And it turns out pretty far. It's got to be about 90% closed relative to its normally properly seated position. Okay. Product temperature measurement. I see some of you are involved in wireless temperature, wireless sensing, right? In general. And there's a big need for that in the industry. But typically, the common practice now is to use a fine gauge thermocouple in the vial, where the tip of the thermocouple really should be near as you can get it to the center of the vial and touching the bottom, so that we can monitor individual vials during freezing, primary drying, and secondary drying. And we might get a plot that looks like this, where this is the product temperature. The black line is the shelf temperature, where we've started at 5 degrees. We ramp down at some controlled rate, in this case to minus 40. That's typical, somewhere in the range of minus 40 to maybe minus 50. You hold it there until the material is completely solidified. At that point, you apply a vacuum to the chamber. The red line is the pressure. In this case, it's at 75 millitor. We use millitor commonly, at least in the U.S., as a unit of pressure. And notice that it stays constant throughout the process. That may or may not be the case, but this is sort of representative. Notice that during the freezing process, we'll expand on this more a little bit later, but we have the product temperature very close to the shelf temperature during the freezing process, except at the point where the ice nucleates. This isn't resolved very well because we wanted to get the whole cycle here on one slide. You hold that for an adequate amount of time, then we increase the shelf temperature, in this case to minus 15 degrees. And this is the product temperature that's lagging way behind it. You know, it's fair to ask, you know, why is there so much difference between the shelf temperature and the product temperature that looks like it's from around minus 30 or so to minus 27, something like that. Well, the answer is that the heat is being used to drive the phase change from ice to vapor. Notice also that the product temperature tends to increase slowly during what we call primary drying. The reason for that is that you, as I've said before, you have an increasing depth of dried material. So the resistance is building. As the resistance builds, the sublimation rate slows down a little bit. So it doesn't need as, it doesn't have the heat requirement. Okay. The shelf doesn't know anything about this. It's just going to keep on heating the product. That extra heat has to go somewhere. So it goes into raising the temperature of the product a bit. But it's again, it's something you need to be aware of. At this point, primary drying, ice removal is over, and notice the product temperature increases much more rapidly because there's no ice there anymore. Notice also that the product temperature goes above the shelf temperature. Anybody know why that would be the case? It's not a front vial, but it's pretty close to the front. Right. Yeah. When I first saw that, you know, early on, I thought, well, this thermocouple anyway, must be out of calibration. But what's actually, because you think it couldn't go above the shelf temperature if the shelf temperature is providing the heat for drying. But it turns out that there are other sources of heat. You mentioned the door, the side walls of the freeze dryer. There are other sources of heat that you don't have direct control over. So this is really heat transfer by thermal radiation from the door, the side walls of the chamber, and so forth. So it goes a little bit above the shelf temperature. That's not ideal. You don't want that. And you know, probably one of the reasons why we'd like to start with a clean piece of paper and design a freeze dryer all over again, because one of our goals would be to get rid of this. Okay. And at this point, we increase the shelf temperature. Actually, we could have done it back here. There's nothing much going on during this part of the cycle. But at this point, we know there's not ice present anymore. We're trying to drive off the unfrozen water. We increase the shelf temperature, in this case, to what, 35 degrees? And we hold it along. Again, the product temperature is chasing the shelf temperature pretty closely until at this point the process is essentially over. We hydraulically compress the shelf stack, push the stopper into its fully seated position, take the vials out of the freeze dryer, and move on.